Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, means we can review, and I cannot wait, folks. We have the perfect match between the news and our guests, but we do have to start with the news. We have a shakeup at the State House. Governor Baker says three is not the charm.
Focusing on campaigning and focusing on politics and focusing on all the things that come with that just seemed to us like a big step away from what we should be focused on.
So what is Governor Baker's legacy?
You know, someone would say, give me a grade. Basically, it'd be incomplete, right? Because we still have a year's worth of work to do here.
Meanwhile, Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins' ears must have been burning last night as senators from both parties weighed in on her nomination for U.S. Attorney. From Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Rollins has devoted her career to transforming the criminal justice system so that it actually reduces crime and provides equal justice for all.
To Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton.
Senator Schumer is bringing to the floor one of the most dangerous, pro-crime, anti-cop U.S. nominees in American history.
Plus, Omicron on the loose.
We knew that it was just a matter of time before the first case of Omicron would be detected in the United States.
So, Dr. Anthony Fauci, what should we do about it?
If you look at the things that we have been recommending, they're just the same. And we want to keep doing that and make sure we pay close attention to that.
Okay, so now for that panel. Jennifer Nasur, former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party, also the founder and president of the Pocketbook Project, which supports center-right women for elected office. And now the host of the new podcast, Political Contessa. Also with us, Michael Curry. He is the CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP, and a member of the NAACP's National Board of Directors. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Michael, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so Jennifer, honest to God, I just want to get right inside your head to find out what you are thinking here, because we are going to start with Baker. You are the former chair of the state party. You should just say something.
I've had a lot to say. Needless to say, my stomach has been in knots all week over this. But, you know, I get it. I understand the governor's decision. And I think I don't know if I was completely surprised. I think my initial reaction was, oh, my God, this just happened. Now what? But, you know, I know the governor and I know the first lady, Lauren Baker, and they are lovely people and I know them personally. And I think having protesters outside of your house every single day and protesters everywhere you go is just grating. And so he's had a big job over the past 7 years between Snowmageddon down to the past 2 years of COVID. And I think, you know, in our history, we haven't had anyone who's hung around for more than two terms. He has almost served his full two terms and will be doing that. And I think, you know, at this time, he probably feels it's time to move on and to let someone else take the reins.
Okay, so Michael Curry, I want to play a little more of sort of the party line, no pun intended here, from Governor Baker and Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido about wanting to focus on leading the state through the pandemic and the distraction that campaigning would be.
Focusing on campaigning and focusing on politics and focusing on all the things that come with that, while certainly appropriate and necessary for anybody who chooses to run in 2022, just seemed to us like a big step away from what we should be focused on, which is continuing, as the Lieutenant Governor said, to make sure our kids can stay in school, to make sure our economy gets better, and to deal with all the very significant issues our communities are going to face going forward.
Okay, so there is sort of the main message, but there's this other subtext. Jennifer just touched on it a little bit. We heard it most clearly from Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido, who's also not running for her reelection, talking about having heart-to-heart with her family about whether to run again.
Had some real heart-to-hearts with my family about how do you feel about doing this again. And the feeling is we really like to spend more time with Mom. We've got some really neat things going on in our lives in these upcoming years, and let's take the time to balance that out.
So it's almost like there are two tracks of conversation happening here, Michael, right? One is we're not going to run. There's a lot of subtext there. The other is we've been serving a long time, and it's time to move on to other things. On balance, what does the Commonwealth tell itself about why we aren't going to get a third term or a chance – not a chance. That's not the word I'm looking for, but people trying for a third term out of this administration when so popular?
Well, you know, for any of us who've been fortunate, like Jennifer and I and so many others, to have personal relationships with governors or mayors, quite frankly. I've had a relationship with Mayor Menino, God bless his soul, Mayor Walsh, Mayor Janey, Governor Baker, and before him, Governor Patrick. It's a taxing job. You know, not only managing, you're the top executive for the state and you're dealing with many different agencies. There's breaking demands. There's hiring and termination of folks. There's dealing with really complex issues without the resources, like our transportation system. And then, you know, it has a wear and tear on you. So that's no surprise why leaders like Governor Baker would only do two very long terms, quite frankly. And that there are very few governors that have been, you know, over that, I think, 3,500 day mark. That list is a small list of people who've served for long periods of time.
All right. So to that point, just a little more from Karen Pulido here.
To do the jobs right, all of them, whether it's local, legislative, or executive, require 100% commitment and a relentless focus on the details and to be available literally 24/7.
Okay, to underscore there, but now I want to pivot, and Jennifer, I'm going to come back to you because now we have an open governor's race, and I want to start on the Republican side where we had Jim Lyons, chair of the state GOP, saying that Governor Baker was scared off by Donald Trump's endorsement of Republican candidate Jeff Deal. Think I know your reaction there. But, you know, Deal telling WBUR's Anthony Brooks, and I'm going to give you that sound here, that he's the one who can unite Massachusetts voters. Here's a little of what he said to Anthony.
On the Republican side, I feel like we have a chance to really be unified for 2022. This gives me a chance, I think, to really speak to the entire state. That gives them a chance to understand more what I'm about.
We had a fairly unified state behind the current governor, who had very high approval ratings. So your reaction to all that, Jennifer, other than the laugh?
I couldn't help myself. Like, it's a joke. It's laughable. I think Jim Lyons is a joke. I think he has lost his mind. I think he is certifiable. And I am looking forward to the day that the Mass GOP is in the hands of someone who is qualified to be a chairman and actually lead the party. I do not think Jeff Deal is going to be able to unify anyone. I think that now it's going to be a rabid fest of people coming out and running for governor. And Jeff Deal is going to actually have to prove that he wants to be governor and not just win the Republican nomination over Charlie Baker. They were not, believe me, I don't think the governor or lieutenant governor lost any sleep over Jeff Deal or Jim Lyons ever. That to me is not a consideration. And I believe that there is going to be an actual candidate who can win instead of someone who has lost a state Senate seat and lost a U.S. Senate seat and somehow thinks that he's going to win the corner office.
Wait, who do you think that is? Are you not telling?
Would you love me to tell you?
Yes.
No, I'm
yes.
not telling.
I want you to tell me right this very second.
and I do think we will have someone. And I think that it is very important. And you know, I want to be clear on this. It is not just partisan politics. It is called democracy. You need to have a thriving two-party system. And what is going on right now is ideological warfare. It is not democracy. And so we need to pull together the Republicans that are active in finding candidates, need to pull together and find candidates who are going to make a great slate in 2022. It is incumbent upon us and not on the fake chair of the Mass GOP, because he is not a leader, he's a loser.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead.
Was that an announcement, a declaration of your candidacy?
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you guys have me laughing on Friday. It's been a long week, 3:20. This is awesome. No. No, it's not.
Okay. Now, this is purely for fun, actually. I'm going to tell the control room I want Weekend Review 3 because of the way you just answered that question, Jennifer. I want to play Governor Baker when he was asked if he was ruling out a run for the presidency.
Yeah.
So I want all people who are not going to run to answer that way now and in the future. Okay, but Michael Curry, I'm going to turn to you on the Democratic side because former Boston mayor and now U.S. Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh was asked on CNN last night whether he's considering. It was a different kind of answer.
You know, I talked to the governor the other day. He told me that he wasn't going to run for re-election, and I wished him well. We worked very closely together in my time as mayor and also during the beginning of the pandemic. You know, for this week, I've been focused on making sure in the Port of L.A., the Port of Long Beach, working today on Numbers Day. Mm-hmm. I haven't really thought much about that.
Have you ruled it out?
You know, again, I'm focused right now what I'm doing here at the Department of Labor at the current moment. Mm-hmm.
The silence speaks volumes. And listen, I know that what everybody's looking at is Maura Healey and whether she's going to enter. But so we've done plenty of talking about that. Jennifer thinks there's a heavy hitter coming on the Republican side. Are there heavy hitters beyond the people who are already announced that you're looking for, Michael?
Well, one, you know, the pregnant pause, as we call that, from former Mayor Walsh, now secretary, is interesting. But I think, you know, one, you know, we've been talking for a while now about Maura Healey, that this is her race to lose, quite frankly, that if the governor did not run, folks were anxious and many are excited about her candidacy. But of course, you know, you have Downing, you have Miss Allen, who I've talked to. She's reached out to many of us and had personal meetings about her interest in being governor. And of course, I've worked with and talked to Senator Sonia Chang Diaz on a regular basis. So I think there'll be many others who get that call, like the former mayor of Boston got that call saying, what about you? We like you. We want to put money behind you. That's what's happening behind the scenes right now, as Jennifer knows. People are getting that call and they're trying to evaluate whether they have a legitimate candidacy or not. And many of us get those calls from those candidates saying, hey, what do you think of my running? And typically they don't announce until they get, you know, they field test that with a few people.
Still with us, Jennifer Nasur, former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and Michael Curry of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, and of course, you. So we are going back in time, way back to July, when President Biden nominated Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins to be U.S. Attorney for eternity, because it's been a while, for Massachusetts. Pretty much everyone else who was nominated in her slate was confirmed, as was expected, but not Rollins. Her nomination has been held up in the Judiciary Committee as a group of Republicans led by Arkansas's Tom Cotton have pushed back hard. Cotton has vowed to stop it. I'm going to give you just a flavor. We heard this at the beginning of the show from Cotton.
Senator Schumer is bringing to the floor one of the most dangerous pro-crime, anti-cop U.S. nominees in American history.
Now, I'll play a little more of Tom Cotton's argument later. That sound is from yesterday when the Senate took the first of a two-step process to confirm Rollins as the next U.S. attorney. She passed a 50-47 party line vote with three Republicans not voting. And now Senator Chuck Schumer has to file for cloture and debate. And then the Senate will make a final up and down vote. Again, Cotton vowing to block it. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey sponsoring her. Michael Curry, let's just start with the situation and your reactions.
Yeah, most importantly, I think Rachel's a friend. I'm excited about her nomination and even more excited about the potential for her to serve in that position. And I celebrate, applaud, actually is the better word, Senator Markey and Senator Warren for standing up for her. The National NAACP wrote a letter of support for her candidacy, urging that we needed leaders like her in those positions who are can be tough on crime, but smart on crime. And understand that there are parts of our system that we need to reform and address, as she's done as DA. I would say this, the latest partisan Republican fishbait of labeling her as pro-crime, anti-cop is not a surprise, right? But really the story is that she's pro-police accountability, pro-Black Lives Matter, and brings a fresh perspective to these prosecutorial positions that we've been looking for generations. She is what we should be looking for going forward. Unfortunately, we're in a partisan time. And she is being tossed out and labeled in a way that's inappropriate. So we just got to be vigilant. The national NAACP is plugged in and tuned in. Our delegation here is plugged in and advocating for her. And I hope we get this over the line.
So, Jennifer, Senators Markey and Warren are sponsoring her. And Senator Markey has been pointing out this is a roll call vote, which is unusual, that Republicans are trying to scuttle this nomination even after Democrats confirmed all 85 of Trump's nominees for U.S. attorney, despite some significant concerns about some of them. Should that precedent, what the Dems did with Trump's nominations, matter here?
Well, I mean, we're in a different time, right? I mean, it's 4 years has gone by, and you know, no surprise to any of us. Unfortunately, Washington, D.C. is so crazy partisan. And, you know, there is just no way, no wiggle room for negotiating at this point, which, you know, would go to bigger things that I believe in, like ranked choice voting and term limits. I think at that point, but, you know, I don't really know the DA. I respect her for being a woman, of color, first in that, you know, it being in that position. I don't agree with her. I think she's very progressive. I think she's an activist DA. However, you know, it's the president's choice. And I think at this point, you know, it's going to go through. It may as well just go through. But I do have problems with it. I think that we see what's going on around the country. I mean, I'm as a mom and someone who pushed a stroller around Boston for many, many years. It does worry me what you see going on in San Francisco, where people are now attacking mothers, pushing baby strollers. And so I think we need less activist DAs, and hopefully in her position as U.S. attorney for the state, she will, look at things in a little bit of a different lens.
So a couple things there. One, at issue in the national debate has been her move, her memo for a do not prosecute list of lower level crimes. We've had her on this show discussing independent research that she invited and did not influence, academic research that did show that it actually worked in terms of avoiding recidivism, et cetera. It's early data, but I do want to note we had that there. Michael, this is interesting. And I'm going to play two different cuts for you here, because both Elizabeth Warren and Tom Cotton are arguing, I'll use the word activist that Jennifer just used, that she is trying to change the system. First, Elizabeth Warren.
Rawlins has devoted her career to transforming the criminal justice system so that it actually reduces crime and provides equal justice for all. Her reform efforts have frequently focused on the root causes of crime and have taken aim at poverty, substance use disorders, and racial disparity.
So then here's Cotton.
Rawlins hopes to destroy the criminal justice system from within. That's not hyperbole. She has not been shy about her views until she was nominated for this office, of course. When asked why she became a prosecutor last year, she answered, again, this is a direct quote. I'm not making it up. You may find it hard to believe. This is her own words. Why she wanted to be a prosecutor, quote, I chose to jump into this job to dismantle the system from the inside.
So change is on the table, Michael. I guess the question that I will ask you is do you believe that that is an appropriate role for a U.S. attorney?
Absolutely. I mean, all of these roles have historically pipelined black and brown folks into prison or chose not to prosecute, to investigate certain crimes that impact the communities of color. These are really strong positions that you can do justice and God's work from those positions, or you can do the devil's work from those positions. And that's every level, from attorney general to U.S. attorney to local prosecutors, like we saw in the Ahmaud Arbery murder with those initial prosecutors. So there's always a role that these prosecutors can play and these U.S. attorneys can play. And as having worked with a former U.S. attorney on an issue with was the Boston Latin School issue and having the team there really investigate and look into that issue, I can tell you if it was a different U.S. attorney at the time, they would have dismissed the NAACP complaint at that time. They would have said, don't call us. We don't want to look into that. So the reality is it matters who's in those posts because they determine what they look at. Ultimately, we're in a situation now where D.A. Rawlins is the right person for that job. I posted on my social media, and it applies to this. I said, I'm glad so many people are woke and others are waking up, but some of us are insomniacs. Rachel Rollins is an insomniac. She understands racism. She understands the criminal justice system. And it may take time for people to catch up to her. So hopefully she gets appointed. She gets to serve in that role. And then all the rest of us can catch up and appreciate what she did as she was Suffolk County DA by changing how we prosecute some of these crimes.
All right. So, Jennifer Nusser, I'm going to come back to you, and I'm just going to ask for a brief answer just because I'm on a tight clock here. And I am going to come back to the politics of this now. Should she not be confirmed? Is there a slippery slope at the national level that sends us into further gridlock? Do you have concern on that front?
I mean, I don't know how much further we could get on gridlock and people not agreeing. I think if once the vetting process goes through, it goes through. I think I would have issues voting for her if I was, if I was elected to the Senate. I would have issues confirming her based on things that she has said. However, I don't know if we could get any further into any more gridlock. I think it's a disaster what's going on in D.C. right now, and everything is partisan. So when something like this comes up where you have serious concerns, it just seems like it's partisan, which is the unfortunate part of what's going on.
All right. Still with us, our panelists this week, Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, and Jennifer Nusser, host of the new podcast, Political Contessa. And you, of course, and we are shifting gears here to the universal news of the week, which is Omicron, and what it means for our ongoing life in the pandemic. And Michael, I'm going to turn to you at the top of the show. I told Jennifer Nusser, former chair of the Massachusetts State Republican Party, hey, I just want to be in your head right now on this Governor Baker stuff. So you, as the chair of the League of Community Health Centers, we are in the middle of new news on COVID. I want to be in your head right now, Michael. What have you been thinking this last week?
Well, you don't want to be in my head because it means I'm not getting much sleep these days.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
But I will say this. So one is I like to always pause and just recognize that 780,000 or so people lost their lives across the country since the outbreak of this pandemic. So you think of this, the population of the city of Boston, that's about 680,000 or so, give or take 10,000 people. That's like everyone in the city of Boston dying at once, right? That's a significant loss of life. So I just don't want us to lose sight of the fact that this disease is taking lives as we try to figure out how to get the information about efficacy and safety about these vaccines into the communities that are most impacted. Let's just remember that. Two, want to acknowledge that yesterday, to Jennifer and I were just talking about the partisanship right now. Yesterday, the Bipartisan Policy Center released a report, a task force that I served on, with Governor Kasich, former Governor Kasich, Ohio, and Governor Beebe, Arkansas, and others that talked about our broken, failing public health infrastructure because we defunded it. We didn't invest in our public health infrastructure, so it couldn't do the testing, the contact tracing. It didn't have the workforce supports, the finances. It couldn't do the vaccinations. And this report, really scathing in some ways, talks about how broken the system is, but how much we need to invest in it. Right now, Omicron. Seems to be twice as infectious as the Delta variant, as what's coming out of Africa, South Africa, as of just within the last hour or two. We don't know how deadly it is, and hopefully we'll get that information soon. We know that vaccines matter. So if you've not gotten your two-dose vaccine or your J&J vaccine or your booster shot, make that appointment right now. If you've been hesitant and holding out, make the appointment right now. It is critical, as it's taking lives, that we don't lose any more, that we curtail the amount of hospitalizations and infections and death from this disease. That being said, we need to figure out whether these viruses are effective against the Omicron virus, but we know that you have a better chance of staving off hospitalization or death if you have the vaccination. So we need everyone to do that.
So you said whether these viruses are effective. I know you meant vaccines are effective, but I'm
vaccines,
just going
Vaccines, yes, correct.
And Jennifer Nusser, you know, Michael, we are lighthearted in this show on Friday, but Michael bringing us to a very, no, it's fine, right? Bringing us to a very sober place here and really emphasizing the importance of vaccines and boosters. And something Governor Baker said this week has really stuck with me. He was talking to reporters and said that despite complaints about availability, he believes booster shots are readily available for those who want them badly enough. But here.
When I go look at VaxFinder at mass.gov, I can always find appointments. Now,
they may not be in the place somebody wants to go to get one, and it may be a week or 10 days out or 2 weeks out before they can get one. But given the fact that we have far more demand now than we had a couple weeks ago, we're going to see if we can't increase our capacity to do more.
I find that challenging, Jennifer, in that we're asking people to get vaccinated, and here we are. I mean, these are boosters, but here we are again saying, you're going to have to wait, you're going to have to travel, we will look at scaling up. I wonder if that creates a problem for us now.
Well, so, I mean, I have a couple of things to say on this, as you can imagine. So, number one, I mean, is it more inconvenient to make an appointment for a week or two away and have to figure out how to get there, or is it more inconvenient to die? Is it more inconvenient to wait and get an appointment, or is it more inconvenient to be hospitalized? I mean, I think in reality, we all need to sit back and think of where we are and think of the trivialness of the things that we're arguing about. I mean, there's a vaccine out there. There are still people in communities around the state that have not even gotten their first vaccination. As someone who is fully vaccinated and waiting to get my booster, I find it appalling that the argument is, oh, it's just not, you know, the boosters aren't convenient enough. Go get your first shot, go get your second shot. And by the way, the whole standard from the very beginning was not being hospitalized and not dying. And that those statistics are still the same. It is 0.001% chance of being hospitalized or dying if you are vaccinated with just the two shots. And so do that as a minimum. And then go and get your booster and do it when you have a chance. But if you haven't even been vaccinated at first, you know, at some point, Darwinism takes over and it's survival of the fittest.
So, Michael Curry, in our last minute or so here, and I'm almost expecting a slow clap in response to what Jennifer just gave us on vaccines there. What else are you scrutinizing? 60 seconds or so.
Yeah, so one is we know there's treatments. Remember, Donald Trump had the monoclonal antibodies, remdesivir was an option. And quite frankly, a lot of those therapeutics and those treatments were only available to majority white populations because of the lack of community infrastructure to do infusion, the treatments within communities across the state and across the country. So right now there is a molnupiravir. I'm always messing up that name and other therapeutics that are coming online. We need to determine one because there's emergency use in play now, right? The consideration, whether they're effective, whether they're safe. And then there's going to be a rapid deployment of these pills, one shot pills. I used the wrong word incorrectly. One pill, not one shot, that you can take that'll prevent you from likely from being hospitalized or dying. And this is, could be a game changer for the communities that health centers represent, closer to the disease, often higher rates of infection and hospitalization and death. But we also got to be conscious of the fact that we need to make sure they're efficacious and safe. We need to speak to this to the communities. So there's a lot on our minds right now. Credit to the, before you go, credit to the state legislature for the ARPA dollars that they're putting out into the community. State House and the state Senate came together in a compromise. Tremendous dollars around workforce, around investing in public health. Credit to the Speaker, the Senate President, the Chairs of the Ways and Means Committee.
All right. And that's Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, and Jennifer Nussur, former head of the Massachusetts Republican Party. I want to thank you both for Week in Review today. It's been great. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Now for some soothing, contemplative classical music, played with heart and played with purpose. You're hearing L'Espoir by Haitian composer Sidney Guillaume, performed by a Shelter Music Boston cello quartet. We've talked a lot here on the show the last few months about homelessness and vulnerability, especially as we focused on the humanitarian crisis unfolding around the area near Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard. You've heard people talk about fear of going into shelter, resistance to being removed from tents, concerns that we don't have the right treatment options. So tonight, we want to revisit a conversation with Shelter Music Boston, a local organization that brings classical music to homeless shelters. Adrian Anantawan and Carrie Eldridge Dixon are the artistic director and managing director of Shelter Music Boston. We spoke with them last month about the organization's quest to bring the healing power of music to those at moments of great vulnerability. And we started with a pretty core question about their mission. Of all the things to provide people who are going into a shelter, why music?
As the artistic director of Shelter Music Boston, it's been a privilege to be able to bring classical music into spaces where we may not necessarily see classical music, definitely Symphony Hall, but as you were just mentioning, right across the block, we have a lot of folks who are struggling out in tents or just really down on their luck. And the idea of being able to play and give art to folks who need it and need that healing power of music is almost flipping the paradigm on its head with our organization, where we don't wait for people to be fully healthy or on their feet or in a place of privilege in order to access classical music. But we believe that the work that we do helps them get to a space where, as you were just mentioning before, allows us as musicians and delivery providers of the arts to find vulnerability and relationship building to
so
what we do.
Have you found that, Adrian, that as a performer, that vulnerability in performing music this way?
Absolutely. I think that I learned so much as a musician from any of the audiences that I play for, and particularly in shelters or places where folks are recovering from substance use. That connection of vulnerability is even more amplified in terms of that relationship sharing and building.
So, Carrie, I'm going to turn to you now, the managing director there at Shelter Music Boston. I want to play a clip here for you from a performance at the Dimmock Center.
And I love it when people say, I didn't think I was going to like this, and I really like it. Because you know?
Yes.
That's great.
It brought me back to my childhood.
Oh, cool.
Was that good? Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was
fun.
Great.
That was awesome.
So, you know, the performance included music by Reger, Vivaldi, Irish fiddle tunes, but we're hearing what it awoke in the audience. Tell us about that.
You know, our concerts are more than just a concert. They're meant to be interactive. They're meant to create community and human connection. And they're meant to really bring dignity and respect. And so our concerts are lively and they're engaging and people are participating. They're sharing their thoughts and feelings about the music, even when they don't like the music or have questions about the music. And there's no right answer or right response to the music. You know, I've seen people walk into one of our concerts, you know, in the before days when we were performing live, you know, sort of tense and grumpy and clearly with a burden on their shoulders. And then that really melts away. And the feedback that we get from our audiences is, you know, I was depressed, I was sad, I was exhausted, I was in pain, physical pain, before the concert. And then afterwards, you know, those things are lifted away, replaced by joy, replaced by a lack of pain. It is quite powerful.
I want to build on that. One of the organizations Shelter Music Boston has worked with is Rosie's Place, which is a women's shelter in the city. Earlier today, we spoke with Sandy Mariano, who's their chief program officer there, and here's what she had to say.
We have a lot of women who have a lot of mental illness, substance use disorder, histories of trauma, and I think music is very calming and soothing for a lot of our women. You know, we've always found that music has impacted them positively with a variety of different kinds of music. And, you know, I think it just takes, like with anyone, it kind of takes your mind off your daily struggles and helps them relax.
Adrian, you've talked about that music is a prerequisite to healing. What is it about music and classical music that has this effect and brings this invitation to healing and really physical impact even sometimes on people?
Music in particular is a very interesting art form. It's very ephemeral. You play it and then it disappears, at least in the live context. Yet when you're in its presence, you are transported into a different world, different emotion, a different time, sometimes relevant to the context of a piece of music and the composer, at least in classical music. But it can also be relevant to your own personal history. To say that Beethoven was only about a man in the 17th century who was going through struggles, becoming hearing impaired, is just as poignant today with anyone who's going through a particular struggle. And I think that when we talk about dealing with pain and healing, it's really understanding that we aren't alone, not only within our communities for those who are here to help us, but also throughout human history, and to know that in classical music, at least, we have these pieces that have existed for hundreds, even thousands of years that really speak to the human condition in a way that allows us to understand that we're in this together.
So we are talking with Adrian Anantawan and Carrie Eldridge Dixon of Shelter Music Boston, which brings classical music into programs that are serving those who are unhoused. So, Carrie, I want to talk about the artists who play the music, and I want to talk about the music itself. And I'm going to play a little bit of music here from the song Illusion by Indigenous composer Sage Bond. So that's part of a collaboration between Shelter Music Boston and the Native American Composer Apprentice Project and the Grand Canyon Music Festival. And I want you to tell us a little bit more about who the artists are who are playing, who the artists are who are composing, and how you make those choices.
Sure. This project was a creation of our founder and previous artistic director, Julie Levin, and was really born out of a desire to acknowledge that Shelter Music Boston and our musicians perform for our audiences on the ancestral and unceded lands of the Pawtucket, Massachusetts, and Wampanoag people, and really wanting to give space to lift up the voices of young Indigenous composers. We often get asked, are composers still alive today? Do people still write classical music? And so this helps us answer that question, but also helps lift up the voices of folks who may not be heard and who may not have their music played widely, and really connects the human emotion and the musical stories of all people, but really especially marginalized and traumatized populations
And do professional musicians from the area, do you have to work hard to get players, or do people want to come do this?
No, we don't actually. And thank you for naming that it's professional musicians who work with us. That's really an underpinning of our mission, because we believe everyone deserves access to the highest quality classical music. And so our musicians are all professionals. And in many cases, they're attracted to the work that we do and they seek us out, or they know musicians who are already playing for us. But we're also working hard to find new musicians, and particularly diverse musicians to join our ensembles.
So, Adrian, I remember when Shelter Music Boston was founded. I was doing human service work at the time, and it was during a time when there was a wave of understanding that spaces that the vulnerable were in should be beautiful, should be quality, that those who are vulnerable deserve quality, not just whatever they can get. And it has really become part of a movement. Tell me what you think this work does for the care of people who are unhoused and receiving services.
Yeah, so I think that what you were saying, that vulnerable people deserve the most beautiful places, is such a wonderful statement. And it just speaks to the idea that no matter where you are in life, that you are still fully human and that we find meaning and dignity through things that may not necessarily feel like are sort of the highest priority need. Sometimes it is housing, sometimes it is healthcare, but the arts and music in particular are so integral to being a piece of that holistic care that all professionals in our communities are coming together to be able to serve folks who are really ourselves, our communities, because as we all know, all of us could find ourselves in difficult times. We might find ourselves unhoused or disabled or going through various challenges that our neighbors are going through right now. And it's really just that bridging of empathy and care to do what we would wish others to do for us if we were in the same challenges.
Carrie, here is the finale from Spring Quartet, Op. 59 by Beethoven, and I'm going to talk over it as we play it. You've been virtual. This is from a Zoom performance. Can you get back into shelter soon in just a sentence or two?
We hope we can. We actually spoke with Sandy at Rosie's Place recently and are starting to talk about returning to live concerts, but we serve a very vulnerable population and questions around the pandemic are still unanswered. And we don't know when we'll be ready to return to all sites, but we're doing a lot of different types of programming to reach our audiences and hoping to return in person soon.
That was Adrian Anantawan and Carrie Eldridge Dixon, the artistic director and managing director of Shelter Music Boston. Okay, now, we are not doing hubbubs today because we have a moment of bittersweetness today for us here at Radio Boston. Hitesh Hathi, our executive producer, is leaving us today. After 7 years at the helm of Radio Boston and 2 decades at WBUR, he is taking on a new challenge at Harvard University. We are a community at Radio Boston, so we wanted you to join us in saying goodbye, and our producers have put together a special message.
Hi, Hitesh. It's Jamie Bologna.
Hey, Hitesh. It's Amanda.
Hey, Hitesh. This is Marquise. Yep, that's right. Marquise New.
Hey, Hitesh. It's Paris Alston.
Hey, Hitesh. It's Walt Wuthman.
Hey, Hitesh. This is Chris Siderick.
Hi, Hitesh. This is Cynthia. I just wanted to say thank you so much for everything that you've done for us.
Hitesh, our fearless leader. There's so much to say.
Thank you so much for everything these last few months. You really helped me become a better producer, a better friend, a better person.
I'm so grateful that I've spent the last 4 years working with you. I came to WBUR looking for a more collaborative environment, and I'd say that's the heart and soul of what you built here on Radio Boston.
Hitesh is truly a legend and an institution in himself at WBUR, and I just think all the hours, all the shows, all the awards, and all the careers he's helped launch, including mine, are a testament to that.
We've been through so much together, building Radio Boston into the award-winning, sound-rich, and joyful hour of programming that it is today.
I really just wouldn't be where I am right now without you, and I'm eternally grateful for that.
You know, when I was sitting on my couch a couple months back and I was working from home and I seen that there was going to be changes at WBUR and I had this opportunity, it made me think back to, yes, that conversation we had in the hallways a few years back where you asked me if I'd be interested. And here we are.
You've pushed me to find my voice and to get out into the field with a kit and a mic and bring real, authentic voices to our air. And for that experience, for all the laughs we've had along the way, I will always be grateful.
You have always brought the emotion to our work, be it reciting ancient poetry, speaking beautiful Francais, or reminding us of the magic of radio. You are magic, my friend, and I have so much to thank you for from the bottom of my heart.
I'm going to miss you a lot, but I'm excited to visit you at Harvard.
There was never any doubt that you wanted each of us to bring our whole selves to the job and to feel comfortable expressing that openly and honestly. You know, whether we agreed or disagreed with you, you always made sure we all had a chance to speak, and you always listened.
And Hitesh, we're going to miss you so much, and we wish you nothing but the best in your next chapter.
Thank you for the opportunity, and spread them wings, my guy. Be free. I'm very happy for you.
This is goodbye in the short term, but I'm so happy for you, and I really can't wait to hear about everything that you'll do in the future.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart for being such a kind and caring boss, a talented and professional coworker, and a true friend that I really do feel so lucky to know. We're going to miss you like crazy, man. But I can also say we are truly excited to see where your talent, leadership, and vision take you next.
And, because we need poetry, as the poet Dante writes, "Do not fear, for none can hinder our passage." Godspeed, Hitesh.
And keep the custom pants.
Godspeed, Hitesh. Thank you so much for all you've done. We can't wait to see what you'll do next. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer this last day is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for spending the week with us. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.